are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
Welcome to the podcast with a thousand faces. I'm Tyler Lapkin, podcast producer for the Joseph Campbell Foundation. In this episode, we embark on a journey where the worlds of dance and mythology converge. Our guest today, Nancy Allison, is a New York-based performer, choreographer, filmmaker, and educator who has not only danced on stages around the world, but has also expertly woven the threads of dance, myth, and storytelling into her life's work. Nancy's remarkable career is marked by an exploration of how dance serves as a living mythology, a physical language that transcends words to connect us with timeless stories and archetypes. Nancy is the executive producer and featured dancer in the celebrated video archive, Dance and Myth, The World of Jean Erdman, a project that pays homage to Campbell's wife, the legendary modern dancer, Jean Erdman. And she is also the editor of the Joseph Campbell Foundation's The Ecstasy of Being, Mythology and Dance. In this conversation, we explore her deep ties with Jean Erdman and Joseph Campbell, uncover the relationship between dance and myth, and discover the transformative power of movement and storytelling. So sit back and relax as we delve into the rhythms of Nancy's life and her relationship with Jean Erdman and Joseph Campbell. Nancy Allison, welcome to the podcast with a thousand faces. Thank you so much for making the time to be here with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So to start, I think back to the power of myth when Bill Moyers is talking with Joe about what it means to follow your bliss, follow one's bliss. And when asked about the experience with it, with his own experience, Joe says, well, it started with studying Native Americans, and then it went on to more and more mythological matters, the arts. And once he met Jean, then the dance came in. And it seems to me like dance is at least of part of your bliss in this life. So what led you to begin dancing?
Well, very definitely bliss. The dance is very much part of my bliss in living this life. But what led me to it is something very prosaic, very practical. My older sister had weak ankles, and my mother said, what should I do for her? And the doctor said, pediatrician who took care of everything then, said, why don't you take her to dance class? And since I was the younger sister, I got dragged wherever the older sister went. And so off the two of us went to the local church basement to join classes of creative dance. And I loved it right from the beginning. And after about two years, then my mother took us downtown. I grew up in Baltimore. So we went to the Peabody Conservatory, which is had a dance program then, of course, very famous for their music program. And we continued taking dance there. That was more technical, more in the Martha Graham style. And after about two more years of that, my sister's ankles were strong enough. And she said, I'm done with this, enough with that prescription. But I was not done with that, not at all. And at that point, my mother said, well, what do you want to do? And I had seen the ballerinas practicing. I'd seen the tulle skirts and the satin shoes. And I went, that's what I want. So I began studying ballet. And when I was nine, the Bolshoi Ballet was making a very big tour of the United States. And this was back in the day when diplomacy was done during this Cold War period, often through culture. And the Bolshoi had a brilliant plan, I have to admit, that they made a ballet that would use student dancers. And in each city they went to, they auditioned American children to be the student dancers. And so I was dragged to that audition. And out of the 500 or so children that showed up, I was chosen to be in it. And from then on, it was just like, that's it. I'm going forward.
So your sister's weak ankles opened you to this whole new experience. And then you took it from there.
Yes.
Doors opened and here you are.
Oh yeah. It wasn't a straight path, but yes, it was clear that I loved dancing.
Well, so far in our interviews on this podcast, relatively few of our guests have actually had any real in-depth life experience with Campbell. And most have only been influenced by him or his work in some way, but they didn't actually know him personally. But from what I know about you and your work, you knew both Joe and his wife, Jean Erdman, quite well. So how did you first meet Joe and Jean?
Yes, it was another chance. Well, a chance encounter, as you know, as Joe would say, by chance. That happened by chance. But I continued dancing, and in suburban Baltimore, there weren't a lot of opportunities. So I also worked in theater, in children's theater and community theater. And so by the time I was ready to go to university, I went to a university to study theater, but there also was a dance program there. And this dance program didn't have really any ballet at all or any theater dance. It was at Ohio University, Athens, Ohio, the foothills of Appalachia, the dance program was started by a wonderful woman named Shirley Wimmer. And the year that I came out there to go to school, another woman came, and her name, to be a teacher there, her name was Gladys Balin. Gladys was a born and raised New Yorker. And she had danced in the Nicolai Dance Theater. Probably, if you're not a dance person, that name probably doesn't mean anything to you. But it was all the rage in the 50s and 60s throughout the country. And it comes from the German expressionist lineage of dance. And it was a big company. I don't know how Jean met Gladys, but she did, and she invited Gladys to be an instructor on the founding faculty at the NYU School of the Arts in New York. Jean was the founding director of that program there, and Gladys taught there, and I'm sure she was a fabulous teacher. But at a certain point, she left New York. She had a son. She wanted to raise him outside of New York, and Shirley Wimmer invited her to come to Athens. So I walk in the door and I say, well, I'm a theater major, but I've always danced. I want to dance. They say, well, you have to go through an audition. I said, well, okay, I'll audition. And I, the dance department was so small. It was in a building on the third floor of the drugstore in the town. And I went in the evening to this audition, and there was Gladys playing the drums, sitting on the floor, playing this five count rhythm, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. You know, we had to do this step hopping pattern across the floor, and it was like, whoa, and this is amazing. It was absolutely amazing. And I was enthralled, I was accepted into the program. So I was doing this double major in dance and theater. And at one point, Gladys said to me, you ought to meet Jean Erdman. And not knowing anything about modern dance, because I had become, you know, a ballet baby, I said, who's that? She said, oh, she's a dancer, choreographer in New York. You should meet her. I said, okay, great. And she wrote me a letter of introduction to Jean. And I went on my spring break to New York, which I did, you know, often, because from Baltimore to New York wasn't far.
What year would you say this was?
I think it was the spring of 1974.
Okay.
Okay. So I had 2 years then. I was my I was in my sophomore year. And I remember I went to meet Jean in her studio. Then it was the Theater of the Open Eye studio. It was on Lower Fifth Avenue in the West Village. And so, you know, she, whatever she knew about me, she knew from Gladys. I didn't have an audition. The idea was that I would come and do an internship at Theater of the Open Eye. And so we talked a little bit. The one thing I remember was she looked at me and she said, "How tall are you?" And I was wearing very high shoes with pants that covered it, not to look taller particularly, but then I remember taking my shoes off and she went, "Oh, you're very short." but anyway, she decided that, sure, I could come and be an intern. Well, that summer also, so I was going to do it that summer, but I was given a scholarship to Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in Massachusetts. That's the oldest dance festival in the United States. And it was established by Ted Shawn, who I think I'm going to tell you about later. Ruth St. Denis and Ted Shawn, two of the great progenitors of modern dance. So it was a great opportunity. And I had to tell Jean that, you know, I got this scholarship. And I was, of course, very nervous because I still wanted to do the internship, you know. And when I explained what happened, she said, "Well, that's all right. You go do that, and then, you know, we'll find another time to do this internship." And it's so interesting. That's such a great story just because it was great for me, but also because years later, I learned the story of Jean being invited into Martha Graham's company at the same time that her parents decided to take this trip around the world. You know, and she had to go ask Martha, you know, say that I've been invited to take this trip around the world but I want to come to your company. And Graham said to her, at least this is what Jean said, "Well, that's fine. Go take that trip and then you can come back to me later." So I did. And I came back. It was set up that I would come back in the autumn of 1975 and spend my first semester of my senior year of college as an intern with the Theater of the Open Eye.
So speaking about the Theater of the Open Eye, I did a little research. Maybe it was from the introduction of your book that we'll talk about a little later. But it opened in 1972. I believe that Joe had just retired from teaching at Sarah Lawrence. And it was at a time when Jean had sort of gained greater artistic and financial success. And they founded this theater, the Theater of the Open Eye, together in New York City. And I've heard about it in a lot of Joe's lectures. A lot of his lectures were recorded there. And it's mentioned often, but I haven't really heard that much of what it was like to actually be there and what other things it was used for. I know it was a dance studio and Joe gave lectures, but what was it like and what was your experience of being there?
Well, you're right, everything you've said. The theater was founded in 72, and the first production of the Theater of the Open Eye was a piece called Moon Mysteries, Three Plays for Dancers by William Butler Yeats. And they were three of his, what he called Irish No Plays, No, N-O-H, being the ancient Japanese dance theater form from the 14th century.
Interesting.
Yes. So already, you know, here you have this Japanese ancient form, the oldest continuously performed dance theater in the world that we know of. And all the content is from Irish mythology. Okay. So you're already crossing cultures. And that piece, Jean actually worked on that piece for a couple of years because she was altered what the three plays were and so forth and so on. But it received a lot of praise from Drama Desk and, you know, critical praise. So that was the first production of The Open Eye. And so the three plays were A Full Moon in March, The Lame Man and the Beggar, and The Only Jealousy of Emer. I could take more than an hour to talk about this production with you, but I think I'll just leave it there for the moment. The way Gene staged the plays, because Yates did give a lot of stage direction, so she was working with that, but her style of theater was also, I mean, it was not just Japanese inspired, because she grew up in Hawaii. You know, she had this whole Southeast Polynesian, Southeast Asian inspiration that she had developed, you know, from that trip around the world and from developing her own dance repertory in the 40s and 50s. So it was a very complex and deep work. And it used dancers, actors, musicians, sometimes puppeteers. There were a lot of large masks, which were The Full Moon in March was designed by Ralph Lee, fantastic mask maker and costumer. He was the person who originated the Halloween parade in New York. Fantastic. So that first year, that in 75 when I came, was a great time to be a modern dancer, because the NEA dance touring program was in full swing. So there was lots of money to tour dance from New York around the country. There was a real effort to spread that, because dance, New York was so much the center of dance then. You know, it's still the center, but the Reagan era changed it enormously. We won't go there.
Once you met Gene and you guys did these performances together, how did your relationship evolve, and what was it like to work with her?
Well, on that tour, that first tour, I was just given the job of being the wardrobe mistress, but I was also the general understudy for all female roles. And nobody was teaching me anything. I came to every rehearsal, of course. I mean, that's what I wanted to be doing. Took class in the morning, then came to rehearsal. And I was just following along, you know, over on the side, taking my notes. I was 20-something, but I was a young 20-something. This was way over my head in terms of intellectually what was happening. You know, but dance-wise, I was just taking it all in, lapping it all up. And I don't think, you know, Jean wasn't really speaking to me much. She was busy. It was a company of 20 people. And as would happen, one of the dancers became ill on the tour. And in 3 nights, I had to go on in the two pieces in Moon Mysteries in two different dances, one of which I had to dance on point as the attendant to the queen in Full Moon in March. So we had to dance on point, classical work, but with these Ralph Lee costumes. The two attendants were the moving aspect to the queen, who was an actress, who was the speaking aspect. And we had these long plastic stingers, like hornet stingers behind us, you know, and we were interacting with furniture and, you know, stage sets and people and text and music. And, you know, there was so much to learn in a couple of hours. And then, you know, I had to go on stage and do it. And I did. And then the third piece was The Only Jealousy of Emer. Emer was a queen, the big hero Cuchulainn, the Irish hero Cuchulainn. So it all happened by the Irish Sea. And I was, one of the people was operating the sea, which was these long 15-foot silk scarves. So we were dancing, and other people were dancing in between us. You had to learn all that choreography. And then in Haitian Suite, I had to play Aizan, the goddess of the crossroads, which was a fairly simple dance, but I had to hold and manipulate these huge sheaths of a wheat, you know, and Then there was another trio called the Three Erzulis. Erzuli was a goddess of love. I did that. And then I also had to play a musical instrument called the ogon, which was like a cowbell, you know, a kind of cowbell sound. And I had to play that in a 5-count rhythm and keep it going the whole time all these other musicians were going. And I had never performed as a musician, never. But everybody did everything, you know? So somehow it all worked.
Well, and Jean obviously saw that you were capable of doing all these things. And yeah. It obviously, you know, touched her in some way, because later in her life, I mean, I saw that in 2006, as part of her 90th birthday celebration, she authorized you to be the person to teach her dance collection, and for the purposes of having it notated, and then to have you be the future manager of all the performances of the collection. And you started Jean Erdman Dance to promote Jean's dance collection and her ascetic philosophy. So obviously you guys had a long relationship. There was a lot of trust. And can you talk a little bit about Jean Erdman Dance?
I'm happy to talk about that. It's been a very rewarding experience. But a lot of things happened before that, through what happened that week on stage, yes, Jean recognized something in me, and she invited me to come back when I graduated and join the company, and I was delighted. And not only did I get to join the company and be a member of that, but I got to, as a member of the Open Eye, I got to go to those lectures that you know that Joe gave at the Open Eye to raise money for the Open Eye for free. I got to go. And they lasted from Friday night till Sunday night with Joe doing what Joe did, you know, doing his lectures. It was his course that he developed at Sarah Lawrence, you know, that he shared with paying people who wanted that experience and everybody in the company, you know. So
during the week it was a dance studio, and during the weekend it was Joe's studio to lecture.
He did it about 4 weekends a year. You know, at first it was an idea, oh, maybe we'll raise some money. And it was like, then it was, we depended on that. The company depended on that. But not for artistic sustenance and financial sustenance, sure, as well. But I mean, that's not something you get from joining a dance company normally.
Right. You had this, I mean, obviously Jean and Joe, they learned a lot from each other, and they were influencing each other throughout their whole relationship. The dance influenced the understanding of myth, and the myth obviously influenced the dance. And for someone like you to be just coming up in the midst of that, I'm sure it changed your perspective on dance and myth as well, to be in that environment.
Absolutely. And the first experience was really overwhelming, you know. I mean, it was just too much for me to take in a way. I just knew that it felt great and I wanted to be around it. In the summer of 1977 was the first time that I learned one of Jean's dances, pure dances, that she had choreographed in 1945. And it's a dance called Daughters of the Lonesome Isle. It's a trio. And Jean was asked to put together a program of her dances to do at the Lucille Lortel White Barn Theater in Westport, Connecticut. Lucille Lortel was a great doyenne of off-Broadway theater. So Jean knew her very well and had performed at the theater in the past. And this piece, it's about 8 minutes, 9 minutes long. Yeah. And Jean, as I say, made it in 1945. And in it, she was exploring what it meant to her to be female separate and distinct from being a human being that was a male or a female, or just, you know, what does female mean to me? And actually, it was a, you know, a kind of exploration of the feminine archetype, the tripartite goddess. And so there were three aspects, three dance characters. The first was, one was called the mothering aspect. Another was called the youthful virgin, not meaning anything about her sexual experience, but meaning someone young and curious and optimistic and open to all the experiences of life. And the third aspect was called the woman of experience. Now, in the classical tripartite goddess, the third person is the old crone, right? That's the third aspect. But Jean, having lived through at in 1945 enough of the difficult of experiences of following her bliss in the modern world, called that character the woman of experience. You know, someone who'd been around, who had struggled with life. You know, it wasn't all easy. It wasn't all blissful. It had nothing to do with nurturing or mothering another, giving life to something, but just persevering through adversity. So,
and it has a better connotation than an old crone as well, woman of experience.
Yes, but there's wonderful things to that old crone.
Sure,
as well.
Sure.
You know, for your study of mythology. But I think one of the great things about it is, you know, Joe talks about you have to take the archetype and feel it through your own person and bring the experience of it out for yourself and in your own time, you know, not that it's personal only, but that it has to go through the personal. So that, you know, I think was very much how Jean arrived at that third character. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Anyhow, Jean invited me to dance the role of the youthful virgin, which was the role she had originally choreographed for herself in 1945. And she danced the role of the mothering aspect. And another dancer in the company, Leslie Dillingham, was invited to dance the role of the woman of experience. So first of all, to be dancing on stage with Jean in that way was phenomenal. To feel her energy expand from her center out in all directions, you know, and fill the space. But also, and this is a real point of connection, the movement for the youthful virgin was so amazing. I'm going to just describe one little, like, 2-second part of it. The feet were doing this little leaping pattern. So it was a jumping, leaping pattern. Leap onto the right foot, hop on the right foot, tap the left foot behind. Do the same thing to the other side. So it was leap, hop, tap, leap, hop, tap, leap, hop, tap. And that's what the feet were doing. The shoulders were doing a movement from Brazilian samba. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And you had to keep both of them going at once, you know, while you were going in one diagonal and then to the other diagonal. And when you put it all together, it was like champagne coming out of a bottle, you know? And it was this complete experience of youthful enthusiasm in a way. I mean, I was just enthralled, and the authenticity, the truth, and also the complexity as a dancer to try and do all that, just captured me completely. I felt, I mean, it was a challenge, but I felt I understood it on a visceral level. You know, it was beyond words. You know, that was my first deep connection to Jean as a dancer, you know, really dancer to dancer. Over the years, she began pulling out more of these dances from her early repertory. And with each one that she pulled out and that I got to be a part of, I felt more and more connected to her, more like I understood. Maybe I couldn't do everything, but I understood it all. And it was on that deep visceral level. You know, it just deepened year after year. So,
yeah, I can imagine actually being on stage in or just performing with somebody. This is why dance is so beautiful and different from just reading about something, because you're having this experience of connecting with the other participant. I imagine I play guitar. So I imagine kind of like being in a band or playing jazz, where you're working off of each other. There's an energy there. And it's hard to put into words what that feels like when things are just syncing up and the overall product is this beautiful music that comes out of it. But it sounds like with you and Gene, and especially as you were maturing as a dancer, you were able to appreciate more of what Jean was trying to do with her dance and choreography.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, hearing Joe's lectures, especially about creative mythology and how, you know, what he saw as the role of a creative artist in the world, of course, working from James Joyce's ideas quite a bit, this really, Joe was a modernist, right? In the sense of dance history or art history or, you know, that period. And how one needed to give oneself, I mean, to the material, whether it's dance material or music or visual art, painting or sculpture, and that it comes through you in a purely rhythmic and formal way to identify something much deeper. Not even identify, but be something much deeper.
Well, so right now on my desk, I have this beautiful book. It's one of Joseph Campbell Foundation's beautiful hardcover books called The Ecstasy of Being, Mythology and Dance. And it was released back in 2017. And you happen to be the editor of the book. So I've read it. It's a beautiful collection of Joe's thoughts on dance and the arts and how they intersect with mythology. So what was it like to work on this book? What was it like compiling it? Considering all the experience that you've had with him and Gene, it sounds like you were the right person to do this job.
Oh, well, thank you. You were right. It was 2017, I think, when it came out. And that was quite a while after Joe had passed away. And he passed away in 87. And so it was really such a pleasure to revisit his voice, you know, because in his writing, you can hear him speaking so clearly, you know. Just the beauty of his sentences, you know, and of course the ideas, the what was being expressed. So there wasn't a lot in there that seemed new, you know, like, oh wow, I can't believe I never knew this. It wasn't that kind of an experience. It was much more a return to something that was deeply meaningful and enriching to me. And I had almost all the first half of the book is articles. Most of them were published in a journal called, oh gosh, I've forgotten the name of the journal now. Dance was by Louis Horst, was the editor of that series. It will come to me. I had seen most of those articles when I was working on the Dance and Myth series, the video archive series, because I had to do a lot of archival research.
This is the three-part series that you did on Gene, correct?
Yeah, the video series. And that came in between, you know, all the things I've told you so far and doing this, the editing of the book. But I had not, I mean, the second half, is a small book that never was published, and it's a kind of love letter to Jean, really.
Why do you say that?
I think he called it Mythology and Form. It was the working title of that. And he starts with creative mythology and looking at James Joyce and Thomas Mann in literature and Picasso and in painting. And then he brings it into how did that translate into dance in modernism? You know, and he goes through the history of modern dance from Isadora Duncan and Ruth St. Denis and Ted Shawn, that name I told you would come up again, to the four great pioneers, Martha Graham and Doris Humphrey and Charles Wideman and, I should know this, my dance history, Hanya Holm, the German, who brought German Expressionism to America and the Nicolai tradition. And then from there into Jean's generation, you know, and describing what we call the post-pioneering generation, because the four pioneers, these are dance history phrases, you know.
Sure.
And then we have the post-pioneers. And Jean was definitely a leading figure in the post-pioneering generation. So he tells his version of the history of Eric Hawkins, who came out, was Graham's first male dancer, her husband for a very brief period. Also, Merce Cunningham, who danced, was the second male dancer, who Jean was in the company with both of them. And Jose Limon, who came out of the Humphrey Wideman and tradition and so forth. And in his version of the telling, while he tries to celebrate awe, Jean is clearly the person who most embodied his ideal of what a dancer should be. So that's why I say it's a love letter.
Gotcha. In the beginning of the book, in your introduction, you use one of Joe's quotes. You say that Joe says that art is the funnel through which spirit is poured into life. And then you comment on that, saying that he believed deeply that art, like mythology, has the power to open the contemporary individual mind to a direct experience of the timeless, the transcendent wisdom of the universe, which is a wisdom based in the body and is also visited in our dreams. So we've talked about this a little bit, but how do you see dance as a way of doing this, as a way of connecting us with the transcendent? Because myth can do this. Myth does this, but dance does it also. So how do you see it happening?
Well, I'm reminded of another quote that Joe used to say a lot, but he was quoting someone else. He was quoting Heinrich Zimmer when he said, the best things in life can't be told, and the second best are misunderstood.
Right.
And why are they misunderstood? That's the end of the quote. And why are they misunderstood? They're misunderstood because we're using words that can't really explain these nonverbal things. But that's where dance comes in. Because dance skips the words. It's a direct experience of the transcendent through rhythm and dynamic form and sensation. Yeah. So you don't have to explain. It goes from body to body. And no one has to put words to it. In fact, ask any choreographer, why'd you decide to choreograph this? And the answer is always something along the lines of, if I could tell you why I wanted to do it, I would not have had to make a dance about it.
Sure.
As a musician, I'm sure you can understand that.
Absolutely. Well, and to kind of carry that on, like I said, I'm not much of a dancer myself, but I do very much enjoy
it. You are.
Maybe if I spent a little more time with you, you could bring it out. But, you know, I do really enjoy it. And there are these moments when I lose myself to something bigger. There's this trance that happens and you're in it. And it makes me think of another quote from Joe. It's from The Inner Reaches of Outer Space. He says, "The dance is a physical poem that speaks to the soul." And I'll share just a little story that I think is appropriate for this conversation. I was in Hawaii a few years ago. And on that trip, I visited Joe's grave, and I just spent some time there with him, giving thanks for his work and his insights that have had such a deep influence on my own life. And on that same trip, I went to a traditional hula show. And as I sat there watching, you know, probably with Joe and mythology still on my mind, you know, I had this experience of how the hula, you know, not only is it this way to express oneself and a way to serve as a connection between the land and the culture, but it was a way to embody that connection to the land and the culture. It was actually a way these dancers were embodying this and participating in the mythology of the Hawaiian culture. So what do you think about the characterization of dance as a way to embody mythology?
Well, many thoughts. I like that you chose, you know, went back to inner reaches of outer space. I like to, when talking about dance and mythology, invert that, because dance for me is the outer reaches of inner space.
I love that. That's great.
Because it dance brings us in to a connection with the physical aspects of our shared humanity. Yeah. And what are those physical aspects? There's the felt, sensed experience of your pulse, your breath, your muscles pumping, you know, the relationships of the bones to each other, the potent sense of the body moving with or against gravity. You know, that's an outer part of our environment, right? But it connects through dance in the body and out. So your inner being, your sensations, your emotions, yeah, that you're feeling that come up, your ability to be compassionate to yourself and therefore others. It's all coming up, and it's also connecting you to this outer environment, your physical surroundings, your to nature, to your culture. And so it's a way to discover this enduring connection, you know, of how we are part of nature and part of each and every one of us on the planet.
Yeah. And that, I mean, it's beautiful. And it makes me think about, you know, how in our modern culture, you know, where we lack a coherent mythology at now. We're, as Joe says, we're in this free fall to the future, and we lack ritual. We lack things that connect us in to something that we can grasp onto, something that we can live through. And in our culture, most people aren't in their bodies. We're disconnected from the earth. We're disconnected from each other. We're disconnected from ourselves, from who we really are. We're lost in our heads. We're lost on our screens. We're lost in our own, you know, personal mythology, or these stories that might not be serving us in a good way. And you kind of talked about it, but, you know, what are some practical ways that people can incorporate this embodiment of dance into their own life, even if we're not, you know, in a ballet or in a modern dance company? I mean, how do you speak to people, you know, to get them interested in these things and in a way that can help them ground themselves and embody these things?
That's an important question, because I agree with you with this, the development of technology, which certainly has its wonderful aspects. I mean, here we are. You're in California and I'm here in New York, and we're talking to each other and we're sharing this, and it's going to be put on a Zoom conversation that hundreds or however many people can share it. So it's wonderful. But at the same time, it is taking us away more and more from our experience of our embodied reality. And I mean, even, you know, the scientific studies, the neurological studies, I mean, we are changing physically in our brains, in our nervous system, you know, as a result of our dependence on this, or use of it, how it's changed our society, technology. But I do love the word in your question. What are some practical ways that we can incorporate dance? Because practical and dance don't go together for me. There's nothing really practical about dance. I mean, I think dancers can be terrific problem solvers, but there's nothing.
Sure, practical was probably the wrong word. I was thinking like, how can we all grab onto a piece of this, and how can it be helpful to us? The craziness of it, you know.
I mean, Joe's formula, of which he expresses, put on a record and move. Yeah. It could be just a sentimental, slushy old song. Doesn't matter. Dance as if no one is watching you. You know, that beautiful quote. I don't know. Is that an Irish quote or is that from Mark Twain? I'm not sure. But that is the simplest way, you know, to release yourself from the literalness of our society, you know, and the constant narrative of it, you know, the constant doing, you know, for practical purposes, because something else happens when you let go into the rhythm and the movement.
Yes.
You know? And it doesn't have to be something that requires a lot of training. On the other hand, you know, there's many, many ways that you can participate in dance in many forms, whether it's any of the traditional folk forms that are available. And I mean, people have been dancing on this planet as long as, you know, as we've been here.
As long as there have been people.
Right, you know, and the same time they were painting those caves in Lascaux, they were dancing rituals. We don't have those exact rituals, but we do have dances from, I mean, all over the planet, from a plethora of African dance forms to, you know, the dance of India, Bharatanatyam, and the you know, classical dance of India, the Balinese ceremonies, and the, you know, we have the European folk dances in between there, and belly dancing from the Middle East, and you can pretty much study belly dancing in any major city in America.
Right.
If that's, you know, if that's what turns you on, if that's your bliss, if that's what catches your enthusiasm, your curiosity, you can do contact improvisation, a dance sport form that was developed in the 1960s by a former Cunningham dancer named Steve Paxton that is completely improvisational. It's like jazz for the body. You know, so there's many ways. If you, even if you're a non-professional also, but you want to be involved in a more professional dance, because of where dance is today, and so many choreographers are interested in involving people without particular training. You know, if you are connected to a theater, art gallery, museum, you know, you can often find on the website calls for people without training to be involved.
Sure.
You know? And that's a short-term commitment where you can experience a type of dance that, you know, whatever it will be appropriate to someone who's not trained, you know?
And for you, like when you were drawn in, you know, just because of your sister, you know, any of these things can be avenues where you can get that spark and that could open something for you and maybe take you down a deeper road or a deeper experience of yourself.
And also, I absolutely agree with you. And also, dance for people who are in duress, dance therapy is a wonderful avenue. And this is available through many professionals the YMCA, YWCA, in dance therapy is a way to get into moving that takes you out of the pressure of the life and into the inner existence, and can, you know, help unlock energy centers that are blocked.
Yes.
So that's, you know, that's one of those ways where, you know, you can follow your bliss, but you can get in some really, really dark places.
Absolutely. And
this is a way that dance can help with that as well. So I guess in a way it's practical.
Yeah, the craziness can be practical. So what are you up to now? What are you doing currently? Are you still teaching? I'm sure you're still dancing.
Well, the pandemic, I had my pandemic experience, as everyone did, something that united us. If we didn't know we were one world before, we certainly learned it in those 2 years, 2.5. That certainly changed my relationship to dance. I am still preserving Jean's work through Jean Erdman Dance, which is more now of a meeting place of people interested in the work. You can see all three volumes, parts of Dance and Myth, The World of Jean Erdman. They are posted now on the website. So if you go to jeanerdmandance.com and you go to click on the events page at the top, you can stream it for free. And they are three beautiful hours of Jean's repertory. And not only her repertory, but their archival footage and material, and there's her voiceover.
And it's you dancing, correct?
I dance 7 out of the 11, Jean's roles in 7 of the 11 dances that we saved. So yes, you can definitely see me dance. So there, that work continues. And also, I've moved sort of into dance filmmaking. The first dance film I made was a version of one of Jean's solos called Hamadryad that she made in 1948 that was inspired by her time in Woodstock. Woodstock, I mean, I wouldn't probably be in Woodstock if it weren't for Jean and Joe, as this is my home away from New York City.
Joe spent a few years there during the Depression reading books in Woodstock, correct?
Right. Jean and Joe came back here for summers. Jean was often, didn't spend all her time here. She might go to Bennington for the summer dance program there with Martha. But she worked here in 1948. She had a little studio and she would walk from the Cold Water Flat in Woodstock. And she had to walk through the woods to get to her studio. Not a terrible thing. And she heard a flutist practicing Debussy's Syrinx. And she was overcome with her connection to nature then. And she created this dance solo about that feeling and did a beautiful thing with the Debussy score where at certain points he states the musical theme. And then at the end of that theme, there's a fermata, which I'm sure as a musician, you know, means to hold. Well, Jean took great creative liberty with that. And the hold goes on for sometimes 30 seconds, even more. And the dancer does this fantastic rhythmic pattern movement. And then the music comes back in. So it's this incredible conversation with a beautiful flute solo. Anyway, many years later, many, many years later, after I danced it many, many times, and I was in Woodstock, and I was sitting on my property and I was having my own ecstatic experience of the trees and the nature. And I decided that I could make a film about my experience of dancing the dance and the experience of transformation that occurs for the dancer between all the discipline that it takes to learn the choreography till that moment where you're lost in it. And is it a dancer dancing the role of a dryad, or is it the spirit of a dryad that comes back and inhabits a dancer?
I love that. That's beautiful.
So thank you. So I've been making dance films, and I did that one. And you can see that at nancyallisonnyc.com. You can see my dance films. I was invited to Italy, and I made two dance films there in Tuscany, in the country where the area where Michelangelo got a lot of his marble. I was inspired by a quote from Michelangelo about art making. In that, the idea, and Joe talks about it too, although he doesn't quote Michelangelo, that you get an inspiration for creating a work. And once you have the inspiration, the form is already there. Your job as the creative artist is to hone in on the form that's already there in the universe. And, you know, Michelangelo talked about within the naked stone, the sculpture is already there. His job was just to take away the parts that didn't belong there.
Take away the unnecessary parts.
hard to realize, think of it that way when you look at one of his sculptures, just so dynamic. But, you know, so, and that. And then I went to the country of Georgia, now very close to Ukraine, very threatened by that. But when they were in the early days of their democracy, and created a work with young Georgian dancers, a site-specific piece in a fantastic environment of the anchorage of a bridge across the major river in the city. It was a three-story fantastic space where we danced their experience of being threatened, but young, not all of them were young, but enthusiastic artists trying to bring forth their own creative visions. It was a kind of a trip, a Dantean trip from the darkest circles of hell through a purgatory to a bliss state.
Wow. So. Well, I just want to thank you so much for making the time to talk with me. I want to thank you for your work that you've done with JCF and the work that you've done in the world to, especially with Jean's work and in your own work to get people more in touch with themselves through dance. So thank you so much, Nancy. I very, very much appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much. I've enjoyed the conversation.
One of my biggest takeaways from the conversation was Nancy's play on Campbell's book title, The Inner Reaches of Outer Space. Instead, she says that she views dance's relationship to myth as the outer reaches of inner space. Dance brings us into a connection to the physical aspects of our shared humanity. Through dance, our inner being, our emotions, are being connected to our physical body, our environment, and our culture, making dance a unique and beautiful way of remembering our enduring connection to nature and each other. Finally, dance is a modality that skips the words and can serve as a direct experience of the transcendent through rhythm, dynamic form, and sensation. Next time on the podcast with 1,000 Faces, we sit down with Heather Hamilton. Heather is the author of Returning to Eden, a field guide for the spiritual journey. After having a mystical experience that upended her traditional evangelical beliefs, Heather reluctantly found herself in a place of confusion and despair. But after reaching the darkest point of her life, and with the help of her discovery of Joseph Campbell's work, she began to be able to see the metaphorical messages in the Christian tradition. Her new book tells this story and re-examines the biblical stories of her childhood, opening them up as symbolic maps to the inner world. Heather Hamilton, next time on The Podcast with a Thousand Faces.
The Podcast with a Thousand Faces is a production of the Joseph Campbell Foundation and the Mythmaker Podcast Network. It is produced by Tyler Lapkin, executive producer John Booker. Editing and audio services provided by Charles Mallett. All music exclusively provided by APM Music. For more podcasts and information about Joseph Campbell, please visit jcf.org.